Food Talk with Mike Colomeco has been brought to you by Cento, Calavita, and Wines of Portugal.
Hi, this is Joe Campanelli, the host of In the Drink. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Back. Mike Colomeco here. Mike Colomeco's Food Talks, the show. Heritage Radio Network is the station that you're tuned to, and it's nice to be back. We were gone for a couple of weeks. We were taking one for the team. We were overseas filming in the Philippines for most of the beginning, middle part of February. We're going to have later on in this show three Philippine-American chefs on. So you'll hear a lot about the trip then. I'll save the Philippine talk for the second half of this hour. First half of this hour, we're going to do something fun. We're going to taste wine. We're going to taste Greek wines, which is going to be great. I've got a rep from a company that I don't know that well. I believe Eclecticon, is that the name? Am I pronouncing it right?
Correct, yes.
Okay, which is, we'll get to that, the name. It took me a while. I can't even read my handwriting. I'm saying that's kind of interesting because it's kind of like a pun on the word eclectic, which actually has, like so much of the English language, has Greek and Latin origins. In this case, Greek origins. So we talk about Greek wines. It's something that we've never talked about on this show. You know, we talk about wine a lot. We get sommeliers, master sommes, wine people on this show constantly because that's the world I live in. There's never a night that I have dinner without wine. Even when I'm on antibiotics, which I never do, but I was always like, you can have wine with antibiotics. I'm sure they work together. These will work together just fine. I want to give a shout-out. A couple of Amanda Cohen. I'd like to get her on the show. Amanda just reopened Dirt Candy, which is a vegetarian restaurant that I've always, always loved. I'll never forget my first night there. It was the first night of the Obama election, the first go-around. And Tom Colicchio had a party at Kraft Steak that night for chefs. And it was kind of a weird night, and I don't do the industry hangout stuff so much, but I was there for the beginning of the night, and the election was kind of, you know, I'm always worried about elections and how they're going to turn out, and it was, you know, going to be close or not. So for some reason, that night, let me go somewhere where there's no TV, where I can have just a simple dinner, and I ended up at Dirt Candy in the East Village, and was blown away by her cooking. She's great. She's just this young chef who really does amazing things with vegetables in kind of a not prissy way. She doesn't preach about it. She doesn't necessarily do organic. She just loves to play with vegetables, and her food's great. But her old place was tiny. It was like 18 seats, and the kitchen was really small. She's just opened up down by me on the Lower East Side, on Ludlow, I think south of Delancey. I have to see the spot, but it's big. It's solid. She's got a great team. So Amanda Cohen, congratulations. I'll get you on this show one of these days soon. I guess after I get in for a meal. And I went to a great little restaurant earlier in the week, not last night, the night before that, called King B in the East Village. Don't quote me, but I think it was 9th Street off of Tompkins Square Park. Maybe 8th, I don't know. No, I think it was 9th. King B is the name of it. It's Acadian food. One of the owners is up from New Orleans. He was one of the partners in Herb Saint Restaurant down in New Orleans. And he's he's doing this kind of new kind of whatever. Acadian's the style of cooking, which means nothing in New York, but it's kind of New Orleans influenced via Canada, via France, via all sorts of stuff. Anyway, all I can tell you is the food is really, really good. They've got a great wine list. I had looked at the menu online and was thinking about eating seafood. They had a great kind of deep Loire Valley wine list, a lot of Chenin Blanc-driven white wines. And I just thought, that's where I'm going to go. And then, for some reason, and then I got there, saw the menu, and then I saw the wine list in full, and there must have been a dozen Cru Beaujolais on the red side of the menu that kind of tipped the hat, so we ended up doing that. But really interesting place. It's kind of under the radar at the moment, opened up early fall, has not been reviewed as best as I can tell. I mean, I know the Times hasn't reviewed them yet. So King B, East Village, another great addition to the neighborhood. So let me introduce my first guests so we can get to tasting wines. Ari Soutanos?
Yes.
Close? Was that close?
What's Aris?
Aris.
Aris.
Aris. And Sultanos, is that close?
Sultanos is perfect, yes.
Aris is what we refer to you as. Tell me about this company. How long have you guys been in business? Tell me about Eclecticon, its reason to be, and what you guys do.
So, Eclecticon, as you mentioned, you know, it's the root word for eclectic in English. So our vision when we started the company, we observed and we saw that in the U.S., Greek wine is underserved. There's not a lot of Greek wine. It's not available, and there's not a lot of good Greek wine. So we thought that was a supply side of the market problem. We thought there were not any people that were passionate about it that would represent Greek wine. So we said, you know what, we have to do something about it. We saw it as a market opportunity, but we also, you know, we're proud Greeks. We just wanted to bring something from our country, from ourselves, into the U.S.
It's curious, and I have to say, because I know you had a tasting, and I didn't attend on Monday. I just couldn't get uptown that night. At Molivos, you had a dinner, I think, a wine pairing dinner with one of or a couple of producers. And I've known the Livanos family for years, and they're a great family, Greek Americans, just a great sort of Horatio Alger story. The dad, especially, sort of came here with nothing, started as a dishwasher in a diner in Brooklyn, ended up owning that same diner for years. And, you know, diners tend to be profitable, but they also tend to be incredible labors of love because it's 7 days a week, 24/7. But he was that kind of guy. And out of that empire, he built now, I don't know how many restaurants they have. I've lost track. But I remember when Oceana first opened up, that's how I knew him, because that was his foray into fine dining. It was a great kitchen. I remember all of the chefs that were there. Now it's Ben. I forget his last name. Great guy. Anyway, Oceana's a great restaurant. Molivos is great. He's a great story. But it's always struck me as being funny that Greek wine hasn't made it here yet. In a big way. And I don't know. So tell me, is it a question of the consumption at home absorbs most of the wine? Or why is it that Greek wine has it? Because you've been making wine since the beginning of winemaking. I mean, you guys are, if you sort of go back to the history, I mean, the Romans and the Greeks, and we're planting everywhere. So you've got this viticulture history that goes back thousands of years. Why wasn't the wine coming to the States? Was it being consumed locally?
Exactly. That it doesn't make a lot of sense. I totally agree with you. What was going on based on the way that we see things? Well, Greece has a lot of edge. It has the longest uninterrupted winemaking history in the world, like everybody says, it's 6,500 years. Then the Romans, you know, they took it to another level. You know, then you had France. But, you know, initially it was really Greece. You know, there was a wine god. Everything revolved, like daily lives revolved around wine. And there's a lot of – another thing is that there's a lot of indigenous grapes. There's so many unique things you cannot find anywhere else in the world. So it's just – you know, it's interesting that it never picked up until recently. So one reason was that, well, yeah, production was not that that big. So most of it was being absorbed by the domestic market. Lately, we see there is a trend towards – wineries are trying to export more because the domestic market is shrinking. So this is not a good thing. It's bad news for Greece, but it's something that for us as importers of Greek wine, it's something good. You know, things are becoming more available, and there's more attention to the U.S. market by the Greek winemakers. Now, in the past, I guess there's a lot of different reasons. The Greeks that were handling, that were representing Greek wine, as I said, you know, they were not, I believe they were not doing a very good job. They were very content with what they had achieved. So they said, you know, this is fine. There were not a lot of high-end Greek restaurants, right, as opposed to Italian, for example. And that was one of the reasons why Italian wine was able to, you know, become a lot more popular.
And Italy lived in the shadow of France for a long time, too. I mean, I go back many, many years. You know, I'm an old guy at this point. So as a young restaurateur, when I was coming up in the 70s and all the 80s, I mean, it was pretty much, it was Bordeaux or Burgundy. That was it. I mean, that was fine dining. That's what you had. California kind of creeped into the corner because they were doing great things here on the West Coast. But, you know, it was really in the 90s that Italian wine began to be taken seriously. And when you say consumption, it's true everywhere, but I'm just curious. Consumption's going down in Greece because we know the economy is not great. But is it also because the younger generation isn't drinking as much, or drunk driving laws? Because all over Europe, we see wine consumption going down every year. France, Italy, Portugal, Spain, it's the same story. But why in Greece? You know?
In Greece, I would say that the newer generations are drinking more wine. They're a lot more knowledgeable. And I believe what this refers to more of the medium to high-end range of wine. Mm-hmm. So people, you know, are turning to more affordable options, you know, when it comes to drinking. So high-end wine, fine wine is not, that doesn't, you know, that trend doesn't favor fine wine. So the better part of the wine production is more available for exporting because it cannot be absorbed by the domestic market. That's a way to put it, I guess.
So you're kind of, you know, Portugal's a funny place. I don't mean it in the way it sounded. A funny place because I had never been to Portugal till 3 years ago, and I'd been all around it. I'd been to Albariño, Spain, which is where you look across the border from where the Rixas Baixas, where the Albariño grapes come from, and you see the Portuguese border. I've been all around Portugal. I've been south of it, north of it, west of it, and I never visited Portugal till 3 years ago. I went on a wine trip with a PR firm, and I was just blown away. I'm like, why haven't I been here? Like Greek, a lot of olive oil, a lot of fish, great culinary traditions, and then a couple hundred, 250 varietals that were indigenous that I'd never heard of, and this history of winemaking, like the old European, that goes back since like the beginning. And you're beginning to see more Portuguese wines in the States now. We were there. We filmed a show there, a couple of shows there last season. David Bowler, who's an importer, kind of is in the Greek space, bringing kind of what you're doing. He's the guy who's one of the guys. There's others, I'm sure, who's trying to get Portuguese wines outside of just the Portuguese community in, say, Newark or wherever the Portuguese live, and say, hey, this wine works beautifully with food. And I'm almost seeing the same thing with Greek wine then, is it has this... Coming to the States is great because our consumption's up every year. We have a young generation that's really into wine. I mean, American. I think everybody wants to be in the American market because our consumption keeps growing annually. And kids your age and younger than you, I'm astonished by these 20-somethings and kids in their early 30s that are just so wine savvy. It's crazy, and they get it. And so, and they're always looking for a new toy.
Exactly. So, a lot of things that you mentioned. First of all, the U.S. market is great. It really is. First of all, you know, it's very consistent. It's not like Europe. They speak different languages. There's still different countries. The U.S. is a phenomenal market because of that. That's one thing. You mentioned Italy, that, you know, it was overshadowed by French wine. A lot of people say that Greece and maybe perhaps Portugal is where Italy used to be in the 80s, perhaps. So... of course, you know, the young generation knows a lot about wine now. You know, there's the internet, there's all these apps that you can, share information and labels and stuff like that. So, people want to know more. It's not just 4, 5, 10 grapes. There's so many more, especially from the ones coming from Europe. Portugal has so many grapes. Greece, I think that there is a debate between Greece and Portugal who has the second largest number of indigenous grapes. They're both over 300. Mm. But of course, you know, there's only a lot fewer that are being used
Make the bulk of the wines.
Exactly.
Yeah, some of them are just one or two vineyards, limited production, never leaves Portugal.
That's right.
Or if it leaves, you buy it once in the store, you're not going to see it again for a year. You brought some wines. We'll continue this conversation over a glass of wine. Mm-hmm. What do you want to start with?
So we mainly represent as a company. First of all, let me mention that we only do Greek wine.
And how many years old is the company?
The company's 3 years old.
Okay, so you're new.
We're pretty new. however, I believe we have one of the best market penetrations in New York City. We're at a lot of high-end establishments, pretty much most of the high-end Greek restaurants in Manhattan, some non-Greek restaurants, a lot of more boutique, I would say, liquor stores. So, you know, even though we're 3 years old, we're... you can find
us. If I were to go, because we have people listening, I mean, they can look for Greek wines on wine lists, and simply ask the server or the somm on the floor if they have Greek wines. But if I, as a consumer, wanted to find Greek wines, are there stores that have bigger selections than others? I mean, Astor tends to be a big store with a lot of square footage devoted to wine. Would Astor have a decent Greek selection?
Astor is a great place, yes. Very good mix of products in general. We have a few of our wines at Astor Place. It took us a while to start getting into the bigger liquor stores, to be honest. But, yeah, they started to pick it up. So Astor has, I don't know, 3, 4, or 5 of our wines. You can find our wines also at Oak and Steel, via Columbus Circle, Gramercy Wines, Foragers Wine,
okay,
a lot of places. So I say there's still a lot of liquor stores that do not have a Greek section, a Greek wine section. We started a lot of Greek wine sections at a lot of liquor stores for the first time. But, you know, it's changing. You know, liquor stores, they want to have a better representation, be more up to date with what's going on, and to serve people that are looking for more adventurous stuff. So it's getting a lot better.
Okay. Let's pour some wine. Tell me about the first one we're going to drink.
Okay. So I brought, we're going to have four bottles. Each one is from one of the four different wineries that we represent. So we're going to start with Wishes Aratines.
Spell it for me.
Okay. So Wishes. Like
Wishes. Like wishes, a wish. Like Wishes.
Exactly. Okay. Aratines is
the varietal.
It's not the varietal. This is the brand name. So that refers to the region. The winery is called Pieria Eratini. So I know the pronunciation is a little hard, especially to remember. But this winery is located on the north slopes of Mount Olympus. Started by two winemakers that used to work for one of the largest wineries in Greece. And they had a vision to start to create Greek wines that were very... It was the modern expression of eternal Greek wines. That's how they put it. So this is a very interesting wine. It's a white one that we're starting with. And it's a blend of Assyrtiko, which is the most popular white Greek grape. Everybody knows it. It's known for the acidity. And it's actually very similar to Albarino in that sense. Then we have 20% Malagousia. That's the up-and-coming white Greek grape. It was extinct for centuries and was revived about 25 years ago. It's known for its tropical aromas. And then we have 20% Chardonnay. So this is a case of blending indigenous Greek grapes with French grapes. There's a lot of such examples. So the interesting thing about this wine is that it's aged in acacia barrels.
So that was my next question. So you got to it. Okay. That's interesting. So the barrel type's acacia, the wood type's acacia.
What
how,
types?
Big barrels?
Big barrels? I'm not sure. Okay. I'm going to have to... Yeah.
Interesting choice of wood, though.
It's interesting. It's actually, acacia is a local tree in the area where it's being produced. So that's kind of interesting, too.
And I'll get up and grab my glass.
So acacia has... The good thing about acacia is that it doesn't overwhelm the wine like oak does. And there's a trend against oak right now.
In my world. Exactly. I mean, I think they're that American over-oaked Chardonnay style that was, you know, the Kendall Jackson era of the 80s and 90s when it was just... Somehow people got used to the idea that that was wine. And I think most of us that drink wine are like, what is this? It's like chewing on a piece of wood. Exactly. And so, yeah, I think that we're a lot of... I mean, oak's great. I mean, you're drinking white Burgundy, you're drinking wines that have seen oak, and in its place, it's great. But I think a lot of us have moved away from that, and are loving just trying to get more of the fruit expressing itself, and less more grape, less oak,
more of the actual wine than something else. So this is the idea here, and it's I think they're achieving that very well. So they preserve the freshness of the aromas and the actual qualities of the wine. But the aging does improve the structure.
It's funny. I mean, you get wood on this. I definitely, you can, I had it in the nose, and I'm feeling it in the palate in terms of the roundness of it and the weight of it. But the great acidity that balances it out. So that's that first grape varietal that has that sort of clean, acid, mineral-driven edge.
That is the Assyrtiko for sure.
And what would this retail for?
This would be at around 20, I would say. Sometimes high teens, sometimes low 20s on the shelf. So it's more of a medium range, I would say, wine, which is most of ours.
This is a silly question, but I'm going to ask it because I've asked a lot of silly questions. Some volcanic wines that I've had from Mount Vesuvius, from Etna in Sicily, you almost get a smokiness from the soil. You get a smokiness. This I'm getting, it's from the oak or it's from the grape varietal? Is there a smoky quality to any of these wines that are around those volcanoes from the soil?
The particular one, I don't think it's...
It's from the oak. It's from the acacia.
It's probably from the acacia. From the toast. Yes.
Because they toast the barrels.
I think. To some extent.
I'll give this glass back to you.
Awesome. All right. So...
And do you have, just so I... While you're pouring away, if your website as an importer, do you have... Do you have retail? So if someone's listening to this, we're going to have a link on the Heritage Radio Network website for this show, that a link to your Eclecticon website. Is there any way we can find out where to buy the wines from that or no?
We don't have that kind of information right now. And that fluctuates sometimes. You know, it's kind of hard to keep it up to date, especially for a small company like ourselves. But anybody can get in touch with us and ask, and usually people do. They email us, where can I find this wine? Where can I find that wine?
Bingo.
And because there's another thing, there's so many wines in our portfolio, if we put a list of places, we also have to put what kind of wines.
Yeah, it's true. And then sometimes the availability is only for whatever. I know I buy a lot of wines from small stores that stock small producers, and it's really more common than not for me to buy a wine, drink it 2 weeks later, say, I love this wine, and go back a week after that, and they say, oh, dude, we're sold out. You got to wait till the next vintage.
That's right.
Because we got five cases, and we sold five cases, and that's it.
So that might backfire. That's the problem.
All right. It's true. True. What's the next one?
So let's go to the next one. This is from the second winery, which is called Enogenesis. It's in the area of Drama. So that region, it's all the way up north. We focus on northern Greece, to be honest. So this is Drama. It's all the way up north. It's known to have one of the best terroirs for French grapes, actually. So this is another example of a French grape and a Greek grape. We have 50% Assyrtiko and 50% Sauvignon Blanc. Very typical blend of the north. Mm. This winemaker is actually the father of this blend. He's the first one that made it. He is one of the greatest winemakers in Greece right now. He studied in Montpellier and worked in Bordeaux for most of his life. So he got all that knowledge from France. He returned to Greece in 1985, and he pretty much created the wine industry in that region of the country.
It's not, and again, not so different than what happened in Italy with the Super Tuscan guys starting to look at what they were doing, and then, I hate this bowing to France thing, but you can't argue with what the Bordelais and the Burgundians have done. I mean, they're masters. They've been at it for centuries, and they're so. I mean, I think one of the pushes in modernizing Italian wine in parts of Italy was very much going to France. Seeing how they did it, using barrique, learning from them.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of similarities. The first generation. Are you gonna?
This is good.
Yeah, I mean, I was gonna rinse this one in. But
okay, tell me when you. Sorry.
Let's just do this one.
I'm not on mic.
Here you go.
Thank you. Sorry.
So I'm not an expert on Italian wines, but I think there's a lot of similarities, and there's still a lot of kinds of wines that France is considered to be, the master, like the rosés, for example. So I know a lot of Italian winemakers that still go to Provence to learn how to make rosé wine in Italy. So, I believe that there was a wave of winemakers that traveled and studied and worked in France mainly. Mm-hmm. And now we also have some that come to California and they go to UC Davis and stuff like that, and they learn some more modern methods of winemaking, and they combine that with indigenous grapes and the terroir.
Same thing exactly. Italy, same thing in Portugal, yeah. Same thing everywhere now.
Exactly.
I think that there's a small percentage that are going back to doing it the really old way of natural fermentation, maybe underground, and I mean there's a small percentage of people doing that, but I think the big push has been modernization. Let's do it right. Let's figure out the harvest. Let's get the temperature control right. Let's do our fermentation right. Let's sort of really bore down and become more disciplined in our winemaking, and less old school in that way. And I think throughout Italy, I think that's been one of the big pushes in the last 20 years on why Italian. And they've also changed the laws. The Italians have sort of changed what they're allowed to put in the bottle and call it what it is to become more restrictive, to become more disciplined. Because let's face it, I don't do that show, but there's been a lot of monkey business in the wine world. So this is clearly, you can't mistake the Sauvignon Blanc.
Yes.
So, blind tasting, I'm just saying Sauvignon Blanc, either 100% or a big percentage.
Mm-hmm. But then on the palate.
And it has more of that sort of tropical fruit note. Mm-hmm. So Sauvignon Blanc originated in Bordeaux, moved its way up to the Loire Valley. Because Sauvignon Blanc Semillon or the Bordeaux Blanc, two grapes in the Bordeaux Blanc blends. Loire Valley has a different style. And then as it moves to the other parts of the planet, it can really become more aggressive, more tropical. This is kind of somewhere in the middle-ish.
But this is only half Sauvignon Blanc. The other half is Assyrtiko. And there are some aromas that are coming from the Assyrtiko as well. One thing we should say about Assyrtiko is that most people know, identify Assyrtiko as a Santorini grape, which is its indigenous Santorini. But as they say, it found a second home in mainland Greece. And this is from the north, where the climate is totally different. It's more continental, right? So the Assyrtiko and all the whites tend to be more elegant. They have more aromas. So some of the aromas we get from the Assyrtiko here, some of the peachy notes come from the Assyrtiko. But then on the palate, you know, you definitely, you can feel the explosion. There's all that acidity that
hits you. It's really long finish on this wine, too.
Very long.
Like, remarkably long finish. Mm-hmm. There's, I don't know what the residual sugar is, but it's more than I thought. Not that it's sweet at all, but initially there's that kind of pleasant fruit sugar. And then as soon as that recedes, it's just bang, minerality bound with acid, and it just goes on. I mean, it's... I think my last sip was a minute ago, and I'm like, damn, this is a great one. So this is $30 a bottle, I'm guessing?
No, actually, this is low 20s, maybe 22.
It's delicious, delicious.
It's great.
Empty glass.
Awesome. And if you want, we can move to the reds.
Yes, please. We'll do that.
So the one that we just tried right now is called Enino. One thing I wanted to add is that as a company, I was telling you earlier before we go on air that we're not, we just want to change things a little bit. We're not just an importer. We're also a marketer, you could say, but we're trying to create experiences, more holistic experiences. In the past, before we started the company, we were seeing a lot of non-Greek wineries using a lot of Greek concepts because there's so much richness to it. And the Greeks were not. They just couldn't pull it off. So we said, you know what? We have to create these experiences and just give the world something that is much more than the juice in the bottle. So we're creating these experiences and these concepts that stem from ancient Greece. So in a way, we like to say that these are like museums in a bottle. So Enino comes from the ancient phrase Enino Aletheia, which means truth in wine, before the Romans came up with In Vino
Veritas.
So we can move to the first red.
Yeah.
Should I use the same glass?
Same glass. It wouldn't bother me a bit. Maybe because the Sauvignon Blanc, give it a rinse. Actually, we have clean glasses. Use a clean glass. Yeah, we have. We're not short on glasses here.
So we're moving on to a third winery, which is called Dugos. That one is from the south slopes of Mount Olympus, from a region that has a PDO status or higher quality appellation status. It's called Rapsani. A lot of people that know a thing or two about Greek wine, they know Rapsani. And one thing that is very important here is that this is a blend with Ksinomavro. Ksinomavro is an amazing red Greek grape. It's like the equivalent of the Assyrtiko, but for the red wine. So Ksinomavro means, people usually call here Xenomavro, but the right pronunciation is Ksinomavro. It means acid black or sour black. It's known to have a lot of tannins. A lot of people compare it to Nebbiolo. Some people say that it's on the palate like Nebbiolo, but on the nose it's like Pinot Noir because it's more aromatic, it's earthier. So here we have a PDO Rapsani, which is certified organic, as is all the winery. You know, the wine production from this winery is certified organic. And we have a blend of three equal parts of Ksinomavro, Grassato, and Stavroto, which is what you need to have to get the PDO Rapsani appellation.
Delicious. So on the color, it's rather almost on the lighter side for the red. I mean, we're not in the best lit studio, and the only white I can put it against is my day-to-glance book, but doesn't have that big, heavy, dark garnet color. Kind of on the lighter side. And then the nose is just full of berries, full of berry fruit. All stainless? Any oak?
Yes, we have oak. We have both French and American oak, actually.
Okay, so this does see oak for maybe a year?
Just 12 months, yes.
Yeah.
And 6 months in the bottle. So we have...
So the oak's completely integrated. And the tannins are way firmer than I thought. From the color of the wine, it's got this really kind of grippy... So it's got this wonderful fruit on the nose, great fruit in the mouth, but then suddenly this roundness, this you know, I mean, I was thinking this pork chop, grilled chicken.
Totally.
You could have this with a steak.
For sure, yeah. This is a steak. This should be, a stipulation at steakhouses, in my opinion.
This would be a great light choice if you wanted to go for a light red that has enough tannins to hold up to the fatty, bloody, rare piece of steak. Delicious. All right, we're out of time in a minute. Last one. What is it?
And now I'm going to take you to our fourth winery, which is also certified organic.
That's great. So half of the wines we've had so far have been organic, the two reds.
The two reds, actually. So here we also have Xinomavro, also PDO. It's one of the four PDO regions with Xinomavro. So this is from Womenisa. This is a PDO Womenisa. The nose is phenomenal. I know, I see your eyes right there. So this is a bomb. It's from the Hadzivariti winery. We have 70% Xinomavro and 30% Negoska. Negoska is a very obscure grape. It only grows in that region. They call it the cousin of Xinomavro because it has a lot of tannins, but it's more aromatic. So we get a very aromatic wine with a lot of tannins. The nose is phenomenal on this one. You get the typical notes of the Xinomavro that are accentuated by the Negoska, and you get a lot of sun-dried tomato, which is globally unique. There's no other grape that produces that note on the nose. But then, you know, the tannins are really rich.
Remarkable. I mean, really? You know, tannins can push me one way or the other. I mean, there's some wines that you have to have food with because they're not really drinkable by themselves because of the tannins present. And this is kind of pushing in that space, but just really well integrated. I mean, that's always the key for me with tannins is, are they integrated or are they just sort of overwhelming and you know, too big? I've never been there's one grape out of Italy that's kind of obscure out of the Alto Adige called Lagrine. A wine called Lagrine that I've never found one that I liked, and I've been all over the region tasting because just the tannins drive me nuts. This is delicious. So these two are, again, in the $20 range?
Well, the reds, I would say, the first one is in the low 20s for sure, 21. The second one is around 24, 25.
I mean, that's still, I mean, my price range for wines is, you know, probably 15 to 30 now, or 15 to 25 ideally. I mean, that's like a perfect bank shot. I mean, that's a great price.
These are great values. We have these at a liquor store, and they put a sticker on it and said, for the second red, and it says, drinks like a $45 bottle of wine.
Yeah. So one of my hints to people when they're out there shopping for wines, you're not going to find a lot of Greek wines in stores to begin with. Ask for them. If you do, spin them around, because one of my hints to people is look to see who the importer is, who the distributor is. If it's one of my favorites, and I have those lists of, you know, Louis Dreisner, Wagent, Skernik, Rosenthal. I mean, there's a bunch of European wine importers that I know that I love. Eclecticon, you'll find that on the bottles.
You will.
It's a great way. So great way to, this way you know that you've got a curated list that's coming from Greece from an import distributor that's super solid. Thanks so much, Aris, for coming on.
Thank you for having me here.
No, appreciate it. Thank you. This is all new to me.
I'm glad.
All right, Food Talks, the show you're listening to. Mike Kalameko's me. I'm the host. We've got three chefs from New York coming on in a minute. We're going to switch gears and talk about a place where they don't have viticulture. One of the longest stretches I've ever spent traveling not drinking wine. We were in the Philippines. That's what's coming up next. Stay tuned. Meantime, a word from our sponsors, and we'll be back with Philippine food in a minute. So if you want to make a great tomato sauce, where do you start? You start with great canned tomatoes. And what are the best? What's the gold standard? What do the best Italian restaurants use, you think? San Marzano tomatoes from southern Italy. You know, I've heard of San Marzano tomatoes, loved them, heard the whole legend thing, knew they were delicious, but I wanted to go visit the region. So some time back, I don't know, 06, 07, we went to San Marzano in the middle of the packing season in August. They've got a really long growing season. Starts early spring, April, May, and runs all the way through October because the weather down there is beautiful. You're along the coastline of Naples there in the shadows of Mount Vesuvius, and these are really small family farms. really small, like a half an acre apiece. And that's how they make a living, is harvesting these tomatoes. But what makes them great is the typicity of everything, the style of the tomato. It's kind of a long tomato with a really thin skin, super fleshy, super sweet tasting off the vine. We can Cento San Marzano tomatoes in the prime of the season, which is August. They just slow production down, handpick everything. Those little basil leaves, yeah, they're all put in there by hand as well. It is the best canned tomato I've ever had, and you're going to love them too. There's a reason chefs love these things. They're San Marzano authorized from the beginning. The factory gets inspected every year. Hey, you want to make great tomato sauce at home? Start with great tomatoes. Cento San Marzano. That's what I use. Hey folks, Mike Colomeco here. Years back when I had my own restaurant, I had to figure out what kind of oils to use. You know, try to make money in the restaurant business. So, you know, the most expensive oil wasn't the choice, but I had to use an oil that was great, an oil that I would use at home and also for my customers. Came upon Colavita olive oil, which to this day still stands head and shoulders above everybody in that extra virgin category in the supermarket shelves. So much of the extra virgin category is dominated by labels that sound like they're Italian. You know, they end with an O or something like that. But the truth is they're tank farm blends that come out of Italy. But what's in the jar or the can is oils from all over the world that are just spot on price. It's commodity oils. Colavita is the only one that's an extra virgin that's 100% Italian origin traceable. It's a great company. They really built their brand on the U.S. market. They get the U.S. market. So if you're looking for a super extra virgin olive oil, use the one that I've been using for years on my table at home and in my restaurants wherever I was hanging my chef's toque. And that would be Colavita Extra Virgin. True Italian, great oil. So my first trip to Portugal was 2013. It was a wine trip. A bunch of us flew over and toured the country top to bottom. Fell in love with the place. The food, the wine, the scenery, everything. Had to come back, which I did in 14 to film. And this time, 8 days in country, top to bottom again. Food, wine, surfing, what's not to love? If you've never been to Portugal, it's an extraordinary place. Buffered on one side by the Atlantic Ocean, you've got great seafood, great wines growing in all those regions. You go a little inland, you've got more great food, incredible wine country. Of course, Port is the birthplace of ports up the Douro. But my takeaway was, I thought I'd had a lot of varietals. Like, I keep a list of 130, 135 varietals I've had over my life. Portugal has 250 of its own indigenous wine varietals. And they're killer good. A lot of them growing there for centuries. It has some of the oldest viticulture in Europe. The sparkling wines from the Bijada, the great reds coming down south from those regions. What's not to love? Crisp whites, beautiful full-bodied reds, port wine, sparkling wine. So if you're not familiar with the wines of Portugal, next time you stop by at your local wine store, ask about them. I love them. I'm drinking a lot of them these days, and I think you will too.
This is Brandon Hoy, co-owner of Roberta's, and you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Hey, you're back. You're listening to Mike Colomeco. Mike Colomeco's Food Talk here at HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Indeed. We got three chefs from the Philippines where I just got back from. Romy, Purple Yam, nice to have you in the house. We've just met today. King, we've known each other for years.
What's up, Mike?
Kuma Inn.
Yep.
Umanam and Bed-Stuy, Kuma Inn, Lower East Side, my neighborhood, third floor, tucked away up there, doesn't have a sign. Survives busy. Neil, thanks for coming in. Met you on this trip. Actually, I met you at the event back in November.
Inaman Pulutan.
Thank you. Which was, I don't know how many years they've had that, and that was I got to tell you.
3 years.
3 years. Mm-hmm. So we're going to talk about Philippine food for the next 20-some minutes. So we'll run out of time at the top of the hour. And I want you guys to talk more than me because it's your vernacular. It's your food. My takeaway was, food's defined by where it is. So it's an island culture. You got 1,000 islands.
7,000.
7,000, whatever. I don't know. I'm never good at that stuff. But it kind of reminded me of like Indonesia in this like spread out. It's like an archipelago, if that's the right word to use. Yep. So we've got a lot of seafood. You guys clearly love pork. We saw a lot of pork, a lot of roast pork, a lot of lechon. But then you have influences from out of the region that were not like indigenous to the Philippine tribes per se, Spain being one of them because the Spanish had been there for 400 years. China influences everybody in Asia, period. Mm-hmm. Malaysia to some extent. Mm-hmm. But let's go back to that event because you won with a great dish. And just talk about that dish, what your inspiration was. And then King, you guys can all chime in and who was at the event because there was Philippine chefs from around New York, but it was like, a kid from Nobu was there. Turns out a lot of line cooks, if not the majority of the line cooks at Nobu, are Philippine.
Anita Lowe.
From Anissa, she's great. One of my good friends. I mean, so many chefs were there. Talk about your dish, because we sort of, I kind of back ended it. I had your dumpling that night at one point, but I had no reference to the dish it was being made from. Mm-hmm. And then I fly halfway around the world and have the dish. Talk about that, Neil, if you would.
Yep, no problem. So, what we did is we took inspiration of a dish in the Philippines called bulalo. It's a type of soup made with bone marrow, beef, and it's just a stock that is so reduced that all the bone marrow flavor gets into the soup. It's a great soup, hearty, and something that is like comfort food for us in the Philippines over there. And what we did to do to that dish was transform it into a Chinese soup dumpling. And it was a bulalo soup dumpling. So it was inspired by the Philippines, but reinvented in a way that you can have that bite in one dumpling.
And the cut of meat that we kept seeing in the Philippines was beef shank, which is a cut that I've always loved, because it's back in the day when there were cheap cuts of meat before that became a non-entity. It was a cheap cut. My grandmother used to make beef shank soup all the time. So it's needs to be cooked a long time. It's full of collagen, full of protein, makes a great broth. And what you did was kind of brilliant with the soup dumpling thing is you cooked it, braised it, so you've got this really good liquid. Mm-hmm. You flake off the meat, take off the gnarly bits and the bones, let that whole thing congeal together. And then put it into a dumpling, just like the soup dumpling, where you're reheating something that it'll leak out the liquid as it gets hot in the 210 degree water, so that when you eat it, you've got this great liquid mix.
Exactly. Yeah. It's the gelatin combined as the heat, it developed into a soup and a dumpling to hold it in a pocket. So when you bite into it, you get the meaty flavor, the bone marrow flavor, and the intense soup of it.
And your restaurant in New York City, Lumpia Shack?
Lumpia Shack Snack Bar. We're located in the West Village.
On Greenwich Avenue,
yep.
Greenwich Avenue, and we'll talk about Lumpia at some point because we got a whole great Lumpia story. Romy, tell me about your, I have not been to Purple Yam. Tell me about how long you've been open. It's you and your wife.
We have been open since 5 years. 5 years now. More than 5 years.
But before that, you also had Cendrillon.
Yes, we have that for about 13 years.
Which was where? Lower East Side? East Village?
In Soho.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mercer Street.
Yes.
Okay. So you've been at this. And
I met King before he went to the CIA.
That's right. Before I even got into cooking. When I was still a big eater. That's when I met Roman.
Say that again, because I don't think I heard it. When was he not a big eater?
That's right. Okay. Before I became a cook, my brother took me down to Romy's place. Because Romy was really one of the first Filipino restaurants here in the city that I can remember. There were one or two before that, but this is really one where the Filipino community was involved. He would have poetry readings there. You know, my brother was, we were in college at the time, and my brother had like group meetings there. So it was, not only was it a restaurant, but it was also involved with the Filipino American community. So it was a cool place to hang out. And I hadn't met Romy yet, but my brother's going to Hunter College, and he was big up on like, oh, Cendrillon, you got to go. I said, yeah, let me check it out. And he took me down there, and Romy and I hit it off, and I probably around that year or right after that, I decided I was bartending on the side, and I wanted to go to culinary school. So I signed up and went over to the CIA.
And that was kind of the inspiration.
I advise him not to go.
Because the last time I checked, he went to Bronx Science.
Yes.
And that usually means you're smart.
Yes.
So you go to Bronx Science, you think, okay, one of these elite New York public schools, like, do something else, dude. Like, you really want to peel carrots all day and worry about frozen pipes and grease traps?
Oh, 7 days a week.
Volunteer labor. My advice to everyone who wants to go in the restaurant business is the same. Don't.
Exactly.
Yeah. Enjoy eating out. Entertain your friends at home. That's as close as you ever want to get.
Enjoy a personal life.
That's right. That's all the good stuff. So, Romy, tell me, since, I mean, you were one of the pioneers in the city. I mean, I'm sure the Philippine expat community was supporting you because they had to have been. But what was the Western experience for you in terms of cooking for non-Philippine audiences? Were they receptive? Was it a hard sell? How'd that work?
There was...
Because we don't know. I mean, I don't know. I mean, Philippine food, even to me, I'm like, I don't have a reference. We know Thai, theoretically. We know Chinese, well, at least certain Chinese, right? Because they've been here forever. Korean's gotten more popular, certainly, than it was in the 70s and 80s. I mean, a lot of Korean chefs have blown up. K-Town's interesting. But, you know, Philippine, like, duh, it's a question mark. So you were there in the early days. So again, I'll shut up. You tell me what was it like?
Yeah, in 1995 we opened Sandrion, and initially we were doing Asian grill. It was not really Filipino, but there's a big portion of Filipino food dishes. And then the food writers started calling us Filipino restaurant, so we started really turning towards Filipino. So, and then at that time, we had a lot of supporters also from the Filipino, and a lot also that don't like our kind of our style of cooking, way we did.
They don't like.
They don't like our style. They don't like the prices too.
The Filipinos.
Yeah, the Filipinos. So, right.
Because they had their own style and you weren't doing the style that they liked? I mean, that's...
Yes.
I'm thinking, like, look, I'm Italian-American, and, like, Italy's, like, one big fucked-up family. Like, in Italy, nobody likes anybody. Like, yeah. The Romans don't like the Tuscans. The Tuscans hate the Venetians. If you're from Sicily, you're... So, it's not... I mean, this isn't uncommon in food cultures to have these sort of arguments as to what authentic is.
Well, yeah, of course, the authenticity is a big issue. And I remembered, like, we cooked chicken adobo, for example, with coconut milk. And I think a lot of people didn't know that some regions in the Philippines cook it with coconut milk. Right. So they said, oh, you're not authentic. Your adobo is not right, you know.
It's funny he mentions adobo because this, to me, I guess adobo must be one of those great polarizing dishes in the Philippines. Because everywhere we went, we had a version of adobo.
Yeah,
I had no two that were the same. So it seems like everybody, every island, regions, sub-regions within the... Everybody... So let's back the lens up. And what is adobo? Well, like, just the big picture stuff. And then talk about the many variations, and anybody can pick this up. Because there is kind of a core to what adobo is in terms of how it came to be. Yeah. Talk a bit about that, guys.
Yeah, I mean, basically, to begin with, adobo is garlic, vinegar, and usually soy sauce or salt, you know, and it was a means of preservation way back in the day.
Right.
There's so much acid in there that sailors, people traveling by sea, I mean, that's how you get around, right, with the islands, they were able to cook that and keep it on board.
Pre-refrigeration.
Pre-refrigeration.
So it's good at room temp, and that means it's room temp in the Philippines is the 90s.
Right. So that acid in there wouldn't let anything grow in there. Not only that, when you're cooking pork in there, all that fat that rises to the top, that's another extra layer of protection.
Right.
So there'd be a layer of fat on top, and then you have all the acidic broth in there. So when they wanted to eat it, they would just take a scoop of the fat, heat that up, and then take the meat out of there and sear the meat right in that fat. Get some rice, and it's a party.
Right.
It's like more of a cooking style of the adobo in the Philippines. So every family has their own recipe, their own take, and their own type of adobo that they cook. They use pork, they use chicken, they can use vegetables, they can pretty much use seafood also, anything they want.
Period.
Mm-hmm. Right. But you'll always usually see vinegar, garlic, and either soy sauce or salt.
Right.
And then the variations could be maybe they'll add chilies, maybe they'll add coconut milk, maybe they like it dry, maybe they like it wet, maybe they like it with salt, that it's a clear braising liquid versus a darker one with soy sauce.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know. The adobo... Yeah. Because adobo is a Spanish word, right? And people, I think that it's Spanish influence or Mexican influence. But we, in our group anyway, we consider it one of the few dishes or way of cooking that's indigenous to the Filipinos. And I think the adobo, one theory is that the Spaniards just named it adobo, but it was already predominant all over the country.
Mm-hmm. So that's why the name is what it is, because it took a name from the Spanish occupation years, era.
Okay. But a Spanish adobo is totally different from Filipino adobo. Nothing the same about it.
Yeah.
There was another dish that we had called Valencia something?
Arroz Valenciano.
Right, which we saw these variations of, which obviously that was Spanish influence, kind of looked, I mean, at first glance you're looking at paella. We'll talk about that dish, because that's another one where you're sort of seeing the Spanish coming in, and how that dish come to be, and how do you guys play with that?
Arroz Valenciano. Well, where I grew up, in Sorsogon, it's in the Bicol region, and I'm half Chinese. So the arroz valenciana that I grew up with was cooked by a Chinese cook. And they used sticky rice and a lot of seafood, you know, but he made his own sausage, mm-hmm. the Chinese style.
So like kyampong, is it? Or how do they say in Chinese?
I don't remember.
So
sorry.
It's a sticky rice?
Yeah, but it's and he cook it in a big kawa. It's a big
a wok.
That's how I remembered our arroz valenciana, but I don't know the other regions.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely Spanish influenced, you know, from valenciana, from paella. That's,
and where's the color come from?
They use the anato or the achuete or anato seeds, right, for red coloring.
Oh, yeah. Yes. Also, they use turmeric.
And turmeric.
Like, okay.
Yeah, turmeric. Yeah.
Interesting.
So we actually saw the fresh turmeric in the Philippines.
Yeah, those little rooty, stubby-looking, mm-hmm. ginger kind of looking things. And then we peeled the skin back, and I'm like, what is this?
And it's orange, right?
Yeah, it was crazy.
So the Filipino version would be the bringhi. We call it bringhi in Pampanga, for example. Yeah.
And lechon. I mean, how many versions of lechon do we have? That's like the whole roast pig was like huge.
Yes.
Huge.
Yeah.
Everywhere we went. I mean, is that like a signature? Is that like the hamburger of... I mean, it's like one of those iconic dishes that everywhere... I mean, I guess Cebu's famous for it. Am I wrong about that?
Cebu is said to be one of the more famous areas in the Philippines.
And that's where Rico's
lechon
was.
That's where Rico's was, yes.
Yeah. Although that place... I mean, I got to tell you, for all the build-up and all the hype, it's like, go to Rico's, and we go to Rico's, and he cooks a little suckling pig for us and delivers it to the restaurant that now he co-owns with the gentleman that we met. And I have these memories of, like, being in Portugal, a suckling pig that I saw that was an hour and 45 minutes cooked over. And I just remember, I'm like, I can't wait to get into that thing. And I'm like, really? Like, it just wasn't, it was not, of all the versions we had over there, that was one of my least favorites. But he's the guy that's supposed to be, like, the guy, but whatever, maybe it was just an off
So
day.
This was a suckling pig?
Suckling pig, and it was just too, it was oversalted, and you could taste MSG. I mean, it was like the two things that leapt right out at you were, whoa, I hope, you know, maybe I'll find a part that isn't, and then everywhere I went, it was like salt and MSG. I'm like, really, dude, why?
But remember the pork we had in Bacolod at my cousin's place?
So
just
freaking.
With salt and
so
grilled.
Good. So good.
Right? I mean, that's really the good pork. That's what Rico was saying. He doesn't get his pork locally. They get it from the Visayas, from Bacolod.
Which is your region.
Yeah, because there's a difference between the north, the Luzon, and the Visayan lechon. Yeah, because, of course, the Visayans, Cebuano, Bacolod, they don't use the famous Mang Tomas
the sauceless.
Sauce. No liver sauce.
Yeah, they don't use liver sauce. First time I had that was Pig Island. Mm-hmm. King made that. You know, Jimmy Carbone invited me out. I think we were filming that day, and I'm like, what is this gnarly looking paste, basically? And it was a liver sauce, and I'm like, this is so good, man.
Yeah,
you killed it. That
lechon
was sick that day.
Yeah,
that was I guess that was my introduction to lechon was Pig Island.
Yeah, because the South, they say, if you use it, covers up the blandness of the meat that they said is inferior in the North.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, we don't use sauces too. But they use a lot of like sampalok or tamarind leaves. Mm-hmm. They use lemongrass. They use even banana leaves, anything, or pandan leaves to stuff the cavities.
Yeah, I noticed. What did Rico have inside his?
Pretty much that.
Those same things.
Yeah, spring garlic.
And then some liquid. He had like seltzer water or something?
Yeah, club soda.
That was his secret, was club soda. I'm like, whatever. Yeah, he was a funny bird. So, talk about lumpia, because your restaurant features this, which is a funny sort of stepping off point. That's what you specialize in. So you were with me for almost all the trip. Towards the end, you came back to the States. And then we had a Saturday, kind of a bonus day with Tom Bascom.
Mm-hmm.
And he took us to this, a woman, what was the name of the town?
Yeah, we were in Silay, and she was making fresh lumpia ubod.
She was famous for this, and I guess she sells it in the marketplace. Everyone knows who she is, but I'm thinking we're going to a restaurant. We pull up at somebody's house, and she just does this like homemade version of lumpia.
Yeah, for the past 50 years.
Agnes told me she has a secret way to make the wrapper, and she does the filling, and it's priceless, so...
It was pretty damn good. I'll tell you, we had it. It was pretty damn good. It was pretty interesting. And I remember there was that paste that she was spreading with tons of raw chopped garlic.
Yeah.
Like, garlic, I just remember, like, peanuts. Whoa. Yeah. It was like whatever that was. That was really like cane sugar
or
something.
So how was the wrapper made?
We didn't see her make the wrapper. Mm-hmm. When we showed up, the wrappers were already cooked.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But we did see people making the wrappers in another market.
Yes.
And I couldn't figure out for the life
of me. It's like a wet dough.
Totally. What do they put on their fists?
Yeah, put it on their fists.
And they would rub their fist on a really hot griddle, like a crepe, kind of.
Really quick.
Really quick.
3 seconds, flip it, and it's done.
Just like you would make crepes in the Western Canada.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's even faster because the wet dough ball is so quick.
Yeah, it's a dough. It's not a batter.
Yeah.
And what's in that dough? Is it just AP flour?
Because I mean, from what I've heard, it's a flour, maybe a little oil, and a little water mostly. So,
and that's it. Mm-hmm. That's it. Okay.
So that's the fresh lumpia style.
There should be probably a rice flour there. Yeah.
Well, that's what I was... We kept it
sticky, yeah.
Yeah, we kept thinking. I couldn't remember how you get that kind of viscosity if you don't have rice flour or another kind of a flour in there. I just don't see AP performing like that, but what do I know?
So that's a fresh lumpia style. It's more fresh. It's non-fried. What we do in our restaurant, we do the lumpia Shanghai style, which is the deep-fried version, inspired a little by Chinese cooking and Filipino cooking. It's the filling usually is filled with pork, celery, maybe sometimes some seafood, shrimp, onions, and garlic, and served with a sweet chili sauce. But our restaurant and Smorgasburg Market Stand is best known for going a little off and doing different kinds of lumpia Shanghai with different fillings and different toppings, making it a little more modern Filipino.
So just using that concept as a base and playing with it.
Yes, exactly. Because, you know, here in the States, people like fried food. It's an easy vehicle for people to eat and share with their friends. So quick dip in a sauce, quick bite, and it makes a great appetizer.
Great. Lumpia Chacon Grange. King... And do you guys just shout out to some other of the Philippine restaurants that aren't here today in the metro neighborhood? Because now we've got, I mean, Dale's kind of doing something.
Dale, yeah, he just opened up in Jersey City.
I heard someone mention that to me, totally random. Him and his business partner opened up this thing. It's kind of like a little, almost a mini Italy kind of thing. Have you been yet?
No, not to the Jersey City one, just in Brooklyn. But, I mean, it was funny because Romy, when he opened up Sandrion way back in the day, I mean, that was really the first one. I opened up Kumin about 12 years ago on the Lower East Side.
And you're half Thai, I should mention. So you're half Thai. I didn't know you're... So you're Philippine-Chinese, you're Philippine-Thai, and you're Chinese-Chinese from the Philippines.
Exactly.
So lots of blood, lots of intermarriages, lots of typical cross-cultural stuff.
Yeah. And now, in the last few years, a lot of places have been opening up. You know, Neil opened up Lumpia Shack, which is great. The guys in the East Village, you have Ugly Kitchen, Maharlika, Jeepney...
Leah Cohen has
Leah
her spot.
Leah Cohen opened up Pig and Cow.
That's right. You know, yep.
And that's supposed to be Filipino-Thai also.
Mission Chinese has a head chef as a Filipino there too.
Right, so
she's doing some Filipino dishes. So the new Mission, that's interesting. Yeah. He's doing some Philippine stuff?
And then there's the Spotted Pig, their sous chef is also Filipino. Edie.
Yeah, so she's doing some dishes. So she was also at that Inuman Palutan.
I didn't meet her. I don't think I met her.
She's a little.
She's got to be good. Yeah, she's at the Spotted Pig. She's got to be great because, I mean, April's been one of my heroes for years. I mean, April's like a chef. She cooks. She's a badass.
Yeah,
and so is Leah. I mean, so is everyone we're talking about.
Yeah. You know, there are a lot of Filipino cooks behind the scenes, you know, especially even in the U.S. Navy, right? A lot of cooks were Filipino cooks are in there behind the scenes. Right?
And somehow Philippines ended up at Nobu, which is funny. I mean, they only let the Japanese cut the fish because, of course, it's known for sushi sashimi. All right, whatever. It's a Japanese thing. We're not going to go there. But a lot of the line cooks are preparing food, day-to-day stuff for Philippines.
That's Ricky. He's sous chef there, Ricky Estriado. And he's runs their whole hotline. And the whole hotline there, they're all Filipinos. So
and he just opened up in Nobu in Manila.
In Manila, right.
I guess it's that new hotel with De Niro.
Yeah.
And
City of Dreams.
I saw that poster, and I'm like, it's a movie, right? Like, it's Scorsese, De Niro, and what's his face?
DiCaprio.
Pretty Boy DiCaprio. Yeah. And then I'm like, oh, this is a hotel?
Yeah.
Seriously.
It's a hotel, restaurant, casino,
it's a lifestyle.
Everything. Yeah.
It's a way for them to make more money, apparently.
But it's great. You know, in the last 12 years, 15 years, how the Filipino food scene is growing. And I think it's just that exchange, you know, that you need that exchange between the countries, cultural exchange, educational exchange, that kind of thing to keep everything going.
And we came back, and I guess I've subscribed. I don't know how it ends up in my inbox on one of my email accounts is Tasting Table, which is this sort of, I remember Nick Fouchel launched it years ago. He was just off of maybe his stint at Food and Wine and they did a thing on Philippine food. I'm like, we just got off the plane. I'm back in Cape May 2 days, and I'm like, no shit burgers, man.
Yeah.
So they're all over that now too, which is great for Philippine food in America.
Just like
you were in that You weren't for some reason, but you were mentioned?
Yeah, we were mentioned on the lower end part of it, but I think it was more focused on Filipino food and on how it should be considered what for another dining option for everyone here in New York and the rest of the world.
Right.
You know, people know about Chinese, right. Japanese, Korean. They don't know about Filipino. So King and Rami, they started it all for us like 10, 15 years ago. And now the new guys are here trying to keep up with it and try and promote it so that it can be out there for the rest of the world to have.
Yeah, I went through a little Philippine food withdrawal when I came back. I'm like, now what? I couldn't wait to eat something like, I think my first fish back was pasta, honestly, like tomato sauce, meat sauce, something. Because I was like, I need some. I've been on a plane. I've been living in hotels for 2 weeks. I need my food. Yeah. And I started to think, what are those little calamansi? I'm like, yeah. Started to Jones for like crab roe and calamansi and stuff.
Pork and adobo.
Did you get to eat a lot of seafood?
We did. A couple nights we did.
You remember the tuna belly in Davao?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And the tuna jaw.
The tuna jaw.
We had. We'll end the show on that because we were doing lunch and dinners. We felt like stuffed pigs. We just came out of a multi-course dinner. I mean, honestly, I had no room left. Mm-hmm. I was completely stuffed. Well, we got to try this one place. We go there. And it's ghetto. It's outdoors on this intersection on the street. And this guy's grilling tuna jaws. And I'm like, I got to smile for the camera. I'm going to have to. And I had the first bite, and I just looked at you.
Mm-hmm.
And you and I, like, ate two of them.
Exactly.
Like, after eating, like, a 30-course meal. We just demolished. It was, like, the best thing. I think it was the best thing I had on the trip, honestly. Yeah.
It was probably, like... What is that, a 2-pound tuna jaw per person?
It was huge, yeah. And we polished it off. I was like, I couldn't stop eating it. It was like confit, buttery, barbecue-y, oily, smoky. It was delicious, man.
Yeah.
I remember sitting on the street thinking, I can't believe we're doing this. It was that good.
I think we ate it the next night.
Oh, we did. We went back. And we'd already eaten again, but we got to have that thing again.
Yeah.
So, shout out, your restaurant,
Lumpia Shack Snack Bar in the West Village, 50 Greenwich Avenue.
50 Greenwich Avenue, tiny little space, does tons of catering. If you have an office nearby, they're great. Rami, tell me about your place. Yeah. Purple Yam.
Purple Yam in Ditmas Park, Brooklyn.
Okay, one of those, that's the old Brooklyn still. It's not the hipster Brooklyn. That's like Brooklyn. Right?
Yes.
I mean, you got hipsters there? I don't know. It doesn't look like this place, does it? It looks like Roberta's, doesn't it?
A little, maybe.
And Kuma, you have two restaurants.
Kuma Inn.
Yes. Kuma Inn, Lower East Side.
Yeah, 113 Ludlow Street on the second floor.
No sign. You got to just walk up that red door and take a deep breath.
Look for the red door. And Uminom in Bed-Stuy, Brooklyn, 433 Decal.
We drove past it on the way home from the airport. Thank you guys for coming in. Philippine food. We'll have these links on the website. Check it out. And I'll have a PBS, at least two shows next season. And a third show we'll film in New York, so we'll cover it in a big way. Be a big part of next season.
Yes.
Listening to Mike Comeco's Food Talk, Heritage Radio Network. We'll be back next week live. Thanks for listening.
For Food Talk with Mike Colomeco is Real Long Way to Go by Brothers.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.